trying to be an entertainer. These books are a new way for me to entertain people. So I want to make that as good as I possibly can, in the same way if I was wearing a leotard and a big curly wig and jumping up and down on live television, I'd want to make that as good as I possibly can as well.
Welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. And of course, that was the very recognisable voice of the writer and performer, Robert Webb. You may have first become familiar with Robert's work when he was starring as Jeremy in the very, very funny Channel 4 sitcom Peep Show, which I absolutely loved. And I believe it was the longest running Channel 4 sitcom to date. I think it might have just pipped Desmond's to the post. He was also very funny in the sketch show The Mitchell and Webb Look, which he co-wrote and performed in with David Mitchell. He's been in a whole host of British TV and film projects, but another favourite of mine is Back, which was on Channel 4 a couple of years ago. I've just rewatched the first series of that, and it is very funny, and I believe there's a second series coming at some point when coronavirus will allow it. When I spoke to Robert in early May, though, we weren't there to talk about his work as a performer, but about his more recent work as an author. In 2017, he published How Not to Be a Boy. It's a memoir which looks back at his childhood and some of the ideas that he absorbed about masculinity and bravado, and then how he ended up trying to unpick those ideas as an adult when he realised the damage that they were doing. It was very well received. I think it was very refreshing to hear from somebody who's so well loved in the public eye in the UK and have him write something that was so targeted at toxic masculinity. In April this year, he released Come Again, which is his first novel. Unfortunately, he released it in the depths of lockdown in the UK, and we do talk about that in the interview. It's, as he says himself, a bit of a genre blender. It's very poignant, but it's also a comedy. It's about a grieving widow who's given a chance to go back in time and put everything right. And it takes in everything from car chases to time travel. I spoke to him while we were very much still on lockdown. I was supposed to originally do this one in person, but it didn't happen. But we had a great chat, and I was very interested to hear about how his experience as a comedy sketch writer has informed the way he approaches characterisation now, and also how he learned through comedy to write with economy and to make sure that the reader stays on the journey with the writer. He was also interesting about how he's gradually finding his own balance between planning a book and being, to use his own word, a pantser flying by the seat of his pants. So, over to Robert. What's it like promoting a new novel in this scenario?
It's difficult to judge the tone. To put it mildly, because normally I'd sort of, you know, I'd be out there doing a sort of a boffin version of Jeremy from Peep Show, sort of going, you know, trying to go, yeah, mad for it, up for it, puppyish enthusiasm, I'm marvellous, this is the greatest book ever written, and that that kind of thing. But, you know, there's a chance that that sort of thing can get misread, or at least one feels a bit reluctant to go that way when, you know, when what is going on is going on.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, there are higher calls on our sympathy than slightly frustrated authors, but it's hard because, you know, you're launching a book into a brick wall of pandemic monomania when all the bookshops are closed. I mean, you know, if it's all about timing, timing isn't great.
Yeah.
But there, on the other hand, you know, it's a very enjoyable, hopefully, and uplifting and joyful by the end book. So I think in a way it's the perfect lockdown book.
But it is.
It's just a question of people getting it.
Yeah. Well, thank God for the internet, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, it is a very good lockdown read. And have you been writing at all? Or, I mean,
No. No. It's odd, isn't it? Because you keep hearing this kind of, oh, you know, this is when we're going to read Ulysses, or this is when you're going to write your novel or learn Mandarin. If not now, when? And you're like, well, I'll tell you when there isn't this horrible, lethal virus outside the front door, and we're all knackered and stressed out.
Yeah.
And no, I can't settle to any major thing. I mean, there's an inkling of an idea about the next book, an inkling, but I'm sort of leaving that on the edge of sight for the time being, and and I'll let it wander in when it's ready. But it, you know, the rest of the time, I'm finding it hard to settle even with a longish book in terms of reading.
Yes,
I'm reading little things, or I'm wasting even longer than usual scrolling around social media.
Yes.
So I've been writing bits and bobs, the odd, you know, talking to people such as your good self, and writing bits for, you know, the Spectator and the New Statesman, you know, a Q&A here and a diary piece there. I can sort of do that, but stuff to promote the book. But I haven't started anything big. I doubt that I will.
No, fair enough.
Spring.
I've been banging on about this to everyone, but Marion Keyes said something a couple of weeks ago that I found very helpful, which was that neurologically, this is not a good time for us to be trying to be creative, because we're in a state of sort of hypervigilance because there's a crisis going on. So your brain just isn't really built to do that sort of deep creative thinking while in fight or flight mode, you know.
Yeah, I just that sounds absolutely right. And yeah, I think we should all just give ourselves a break. And if it's, you know, if you're in the lucky position not to have to really go for it in terms of work, then you know, let's just be good to ourselves, be a friend to ourselves as much as possible.
Yeah,
you know, everything feels like, you know, you're on a, everything feels three times as hard as it normally would. I mean, even this, which is, I mean, this is a pleasure, but I mean, compared to, you know, what I'm used to, and it's the novelty. Everything's new, and everything, you have to like learn a slightly new thing, way of doing it, and it's all, you know, you're riding a bike in a headwind on a slight incline, and it's not impossible, but it feels weirdly like an unreasonable thing to ask. What I'm used to is you walk into a room and you know, and there's several hundred people, and you talk about your book with a person sitting next to you, and then you do a signing, and that's what I'm used to. And whether that's spoilt and ridiculous, then that's fine. But that's my idea of doing it the easy way.
Yeah.
Rather, I've been doing these kind of virtual online book events, which are just so surreal, because it's just me on my own in this room talking to I don't know how many people. I can't smell them. I can't see them. I certainly can't hear them.
Yes, there's no sort of response, you know, loop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And for someone who, you know, is used to communicating through jokes, I'm clearly giving myself the morning off. But anyway, but usually, you know, I try to talk in an entertaining manner, and I can't hear if anyone's laughing. So it's just weird. It's like flying on one engine instead of four, and it's just a peculiar thing. But anyway, I mean, everyone's having to adapt, like in ways, in various ways. So yeah, I'm not moaning, but it just, everything feels slightly wrong, and therefore, you know, 50% harder than it.
Absolutely, yeah. Although I have to say that I think doing an event in front of an audience sounds horrendous to me, but each to their own.
I'm the kind of freak who feels most comfortable when when it's like that. Yeah, when all the lights are... If I go to the theatre and watch someone else in a play, it's fine, and I've had really enjoyable nights in the theatre, but I certainly spend the first 10 minutes thinking, there's something deeply wrong with the arrangements. All these chairs are pointing the wrong way. The lights are pointing the wrong way. What is going on? So that's no reflection on you. That's me being a freakazoid.
So as we chat, are you in your study or are you somewhere else?
I am. I'm in the room I laughingly call my study. Less laughingly now, because I actually used it on Come Again. How Not to Be a Boy was written mainly downstairs in the garden, because I was still smoking and drinking and just generally, that's how that book got written, in a sort of alcoholic fog of emotional breakdown. Whereas Come Again is an altogether healthier proposition. I mean, it's the top room in a Victorian terrace in North London, a room that presumably used to be a loft. In fact, I'm sure it used to be a loft. So there's I've got three Velux windows on one side and a largish window on the other, and I can see across some rooftops looking south, and I can see the BT Tower in the distance. There's the Shard and the I just about make out the Arch of Wembley, so it's quite a good view.
Sounds lovely.
It is lovely, and I'm not sure if that's a good idea, because it's some, maybe it's not good to be able to look out the window. I should be in now. I read, I'm sure you have, Stephen King's excellent On Writing.
Yes.
His Brilliant. Writing about writing. And he talks about the books that he wrote when he made it deliberately difficult for himself, and he was in this kind of cupboard under the stairs. And he was saying that he thought that would help, that, you know, there's no distractions and you've only got the screen. And he was going, no, doesn't help at all. I was just miserable. I think it's okay to have a view. I think it's probably, if you can lean back on your chair and stare out the window, I think that's
yeah, why not? So
a good thing.
What about the view inside the room? Describe the room a little bit.
I'm a very lucky little boy, and I have a built-in desk, a desk that's sort of corner wooden contraption, which is stuck to the wall. So one side of that sort of L shape is a low bookcase. Not that many books in this room, actually. Most of the books are downstairs. A lot of the books are books that I've written that haven't been sent out to friends because I'm scared to go to the post office, or books that I've been sent free from publishers that I won't read, and they just sort of live here for a few months before I take them to the charity shop. Charity shop loves me because they get lots of clearly untouched, posh looking. I'm sounding very spoiled.
I am too.
I'm often grumbled because I know that. You know, my publisher's done exactly the same for everyone else, and there'll be copies of Come Again, unloved and unwanted, lying around. It makes me quite emotional. Anyway, there's a few books down here. The rest of the other side of the L shape is my desk, which is a normal desk width but quite long. And there's a little, there's a compact black and white laser printer, and there's a sort of rack with bits of paper that I'm not going to think about. Things, there is a sort of vague things to do thing there. There's a couple of lamps, there's a telly. The other side of the room, there's a sort of a corner sofa, but there's also, what else, there's a painting that my wife painted, which has got children's finger marks all over it, which I rescued from the front room when she got bored of it, and that's up here. And it's a sort of she says it's the artistic equivalent of easy listening. I think it's better than that. It's a sort of stripy landscape thing with a sunset,
oh,
and a beach and some water, and there's a couple of shelves with awards, quite frankly, but you did ask.
No, I want to hear about them.
And there's pictures from shows. There's a Radio Times cover of me and David, and there's a very pretty picture of the stage when I did Neville's Island, which is all sort of blue and green.
So you said that you, when you wrote your first book, you were mostly out in the garden. Mm. What are your writing habits now? Or perhaps not right now, but
They're still fairly chaotic, really. I mean, I do laugh when it's a mixture of awe and incredulity when I read those My Writing Day Sunday supplement things from other writers. I just don't believe it. You know, I rise at 6 every morning and have a pomegranate seed and wasp leg smoothie, and then I do yoga for an hour, and then I write for 52 minutes exactly, and then I do various other, you know, I think it's great that some people are so disciplined. I mean, I'm marginally sharper and more alert in the morning and less so in the afternoon. I probably won't do more than 3 to 4 hours productively. I don't have a special routine for revising what I did yesterday. I mean, I'll look at what I did yesterday and hopefully I'll leave it alone and keep moving forward. But knowing me, I'll spend at least an hour tinkering with it. Because, I mean, that's the most fun for me, is the nitty-gritty of making sentences go click and sharpening up jokes and getting things out of the way that might have detained the reader unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And that's the fun of it. The stuff about plotting and the macro stuff, I kind of dread.
Right.
And I remember my agent, my literary agent, Ivan, saying to me, this is supposed to be the fun bit. And I couldn't believe my ears. that first draft, which was most of my 2018, was working out the plot of Come Again. And I found it absolutely torturous. In fact, I didn't give up. It kind of happened in such a messy kind of way, because I sent the first half of the first draft to Canongate. I don't know why I did that. I don't think they even asked. And Francis Bickmore, my brilliant and lovely editor, who also edited Hamilton, a memoir I did a few years ago called How Not to Be a Boy. He sent back notes, which I think was a mistake, and I'm blaming him for the fact the book was then a year late, because I started obsessing about the notes and started to think that the first half was rubbish. And he was right when he pointed out politely that the book started four times over, that any one of the first four chapters could have been chapter one.
Right.
And that was me. That was just me. That was classic first-time novelist being very, very hesitant and kind of circling the beginning and wondering where it should really begin. Anyway, I got rid of the other three chapter ones and I picked the best one. Yeah, but that really kind of paralyzed me for ages, because I didn't feel that I could carry... I'm not one of those people who can write, oh, this bit will go somewhere, I'll write this bit now.
Right.
I've got to start at the beginning. Zadie Smith, I'm sure you know, has written a brilliant essay about this, That Crafty Feeling, I think it's called, or it's got a subtitle that carries on, but she calls them the micromanagers and the macro something else, and... she's talking about people who, the planners, know them by their corkboards. she herself has to start at the bit. She talks about, you know, the foundations of a building, that you've got to start with the ground floor and then build up. Otherwise, where are you? And that's kind of how I, in my vast experience of writing exactly one novel, that's how I feel about it as well. That I really wouldn't know how you would write a chapter not knowing what happened in the chapter before that. Reading is... in the same way that, you know, reading is a temporal art, it happens in time, and it's one word, you know, following another, and it's a cumulative thing. So, you know, some people, I mean, very, very successful people, I'm sure, do it in that kind of moving stuff around way, but I have to start at the beginning and then keep going.
I want to go back to talking a bit more about the novel later, but could you... tell me when you first remember writing, what your sort of earliest memories are of enjoying it.
I was quite little, actually. I had an imaginary gang of friends called the Guy Byes, of which I was the captain, of course, and I wrote stories about me and the Guy Byes fighting crime. I remember writing, and they weren't just daydreams, I did write them down. I don't have them. But one, I think, was called Fallen Hero. I think it was that I had gone out and I'd been battling with the Joker or some other baddie, and I got injured, and then the Guy Byes came to my rescue, and there was a massacre, and then I was taken back to Guy Byes base. But yeah, it was all... I won't pretend it had a beginning, middle, and an end.
But the storytelling.
I would have been not much more than six or seven.
Yeah, that's very sweet. And in your sort of, in the early years of your career, and certainly of being high profile, you were primarily known as an actor and a comedian, a very, very funny actor. That has shifted a bit in the last few years. I wondered how you see it yourself.
It's a strange, really, because in some ways I don't really sense any change, but of course it has, in that, you know, I've written these two books and they take quite a lot of time, and I have turned down acting work in order to do them, so there has been a sort of refocusing there, but on the other hand, I still see myself as a writer performer, and, you know, all the sketches that I wrote with David, I mean, David and I wrote a lot of sketches you know, for other people before we got our own radio show and then our own TV show, and so I feel like I've been a professional writer for a very long time, even though it's sketches. I nearly said just sketches, but I will not I won't denigrate my chosen form for so many years. There are transferable skills, you know, you learn something about economy, you learn something about painting a character very quickly with a few broad strokes. I mean, obviously in a novel you've got much more time, but it helps. And also, you know, I was talking about not putting things in the reader's way, you know, not managing to write without ruffles.
Yes.
Where the audience is temporarily confused, and so they're not laughing. Hitchcock said a confused audience doesn't emote, and he's trying to scare them. I'm not trying to scare them. I'm trying to make them laugh, usually. But it's the same principle. They won't laugh if they're trying to figure something out. You've given them a problem to solve.
Yeah.
So that's exactly the same skill, really, or craft, or whatever one calls it.
How did that work, writing those sketches with David? What was the kind of process there, or when you were working on something like the Mitchell and Webb look?
We really did have a proper process. That we were a machine. We kind of had to be, because we had to produce quite a lot. So we would the ideas for sketches would happen in the pub. We'd meet of an evening and with a couple of notebooks, and we'd start talking, and usually talking about things that had annoyed us, or annoying things our friends did, or annoying things on the television, or annoying politicians, or annoying TV shows, or annoying things we noticed. And this isn't necessarily an angry conversation. This is just, you know, mild foibles. And by the end of that night, we would have, with our handwriting deteriorating as it went on, we would end up with four or five ideas. And then the next day, the next afternoon, frankly, because we didn't work in the morning unless it was an emergency, I'd go around to David's house. We would watch Buffy or Bergerac or The Snooker, or whatever was on, over a long cup of tea. If we were feeling very lazy, two cups of tea. And then at some horrible moment, after about an hour and a half of this, one of us would look at the other and go, "Shall we do a bit then?" And then we would trudge glumly upstairs to David's room, David's bedroom, where he slept, which is where he had his computer, and we would sit side by side. And believe me, we didn't want to be in that room any longer than we had to be. So we became very efficient. So we would write up those five ideas, four ideas, whatever it was, in a couple of hours, or three at the most.
So it was a very sort of conversational back and forth type of approach. You weren't off separately writing things.
No,
and
we did it. We could have done it. I mean, I know partnerships. I think most partnerships do it. They write something and they swap. Or they write on their own and they edit each other's work. That's how Sam Bain and Jesse Armstrong wrote Peep Show. With sketches, we always found we just had to be in the same room, and it was just quicker. It was more painful, but it was much quicker, and we could produce so much more. So we would do it like that, and there were times when we had a really good time. I mean, you can't, you know, write a sketch and expect other people to laugh unless you've laughed. And so, we, you know, our job is to make each other laugh, and that's a great job, right?
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, for two people who were not in love, that's a hell of a lot of time to spend together, particularly in the pomp years of Mitchell and Webb, you know, when Peep Show was going at the same time as four series of The Sketch Show. We were seeing each other a lot. And there was other stuff around the edges as well.
It must have been quite exhausting, actually.
So, yeah, it was. We were pretty... There were days when we just couldn't stand the sight of each other. I mean, perhaps that's putting it a bit strong. But we never had the row. But there were often, you know, we would negotiate touchy silences with icy English courtesy.
As anybody does with a colleague that they're spending too much time with.
Yeah.
So at what point did you start thinking about writing a memoir, and how did you approach that at the beginning?
It was, I think I, to be, to give her her due, I think it must have been Catelyn's book. I think it was Catelyn Moran's How to Be a Woman. And I read that and I thought, I wonder if there's room for a male take on this. And I thought that, well, okay, there isn't really a male version of feminism, because feminism is there because there's already a male version of everything else. Everything else is the male version. And so therefore, should I try and write about there being a male version? I thought there must be problems with masculinity as well as problems with being a woman. I mean, you know, Catelyn, I'm sure, would say it's not a book about problems with being a woman, but you know what I mean. It's how to deal with the specific challenges that being a woman presents. And I wondered if there was a male equivalent, and the more I thought about it, this is about repression, and this is about sexism, and this is about and this is about rule of three, there is no third one. this is about emotional repression, and it's about not seeing women as fully human and fully equal, and can I tell that, and can I talk about that through the prism of my own life and my own actions and mistakes and failures and problems and whatever. And it turned out that worked quite well, that I could I can do exactly that. So I thought about the story that, you know, one of the great differences when I came to write the novel was that suddenly there had to be a structure and a plot that made sense, because, you know, with a memoir, no one really expects a life to have a five-act structure and to, you know, to have a satisfying ending. It doesn't have an ending.
Yeah.
So I went through the memories that first bubbled up, that presented themselves most obviously, I thought would be the important ones, and that's pretty much, you know, the big events, my parents' divorce and my mum dying and me taking ages to retain my A-levels and what that was like, being held back at school for so long, and then university and stuff like that. And I kind of missed out the sort of, most of the Mitchell and Webb stuff isn't there really, because partly because David covered it so well in his own book, partly because, you know, in those years, nothing happened. It was just a kind of gradual, you know, we got a slightly better slot at the Pleasance in Edinburgh. So I did it. That wasn't really part of the approach of the book, but there's the early stuff and then the fast forward to being a father. And it all seemed to fit together quite well. So I gave myself a massive head start. I wrote the first two chapters on spec and a 50-page document about what was going to happen in the rest of the book before any publishers saw it.
That's so organized.
And that went out to, well, I was just in a hurry to, I was just very keen to impress upon them that I knew, to give them the best possible, give myself the best possible chance of making people think that I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah, very smart, so, yeah.
So that they wouldn't think, oh, it's that bloke off the telly, he reckons he can write a book. I kind of had, it was kind of nice actually to have something to prove. And so I produced this document. And that went out to 20 publishers, and I got 13 offers, and then I met the top five, and then I chose Canongate.
Yeah.
Who were not, didn't offer the most money. They were just the nicest people.
Nicest overall.
Nicest and most engaged and most sparky and cleverest and, you know, best.
Yeah.
So, but it was, I mean, that was a very, I mean, goodness knows, that was a very nice process, just swanning around different publishers' office with everyone being nice to me. I can highly recommend that. but the idea for the novel was kind of attached to that pitch, because I had the sort of log line, I had the like two sentence what happens in Come Again in my back pocket, and that was sort of stuck onto,
right? So even then you knew that was going to be the next
because the idea for Come Again preceded the idea for Let's Do a Masculinity Based Memoir. The story kind of came to me in 2012, while I was filming a scene from Peep Show. I was sitting in Jeremy's car, and the crew were re-rigging the lights because it was a different change of point of view. And I was just scrolling through Twitter, and Nigel Cole, who's a very nice man, who just directed me in a British comedy called The Wedding Video, which was a movie that came out during the Olympics, and that's one of the reasons why it ran for a fortnight. Bless it. It was good. I thought it had its moments. I thought it was a good film. But anyway, there we are. It didn't do brilliantly. And Nigel was saying, has anyone got any ideas for another film? And I just remember sort of staring out of the front windscreen and unfocusing my eyes. And Kate kind of came to me in a way that I doubt will ever happen again.
Going back to the memoir, was there an element of anxiety putting something out there that was quite different to what people had seen of you before? I mean, you knew you could do it, it sounds like, but was that a bit nerve-wracking?
Not nerve-wracking. I mean, it was nerve-wracking in the sense that I was worried no one would read it. I certainly thought there was a very strong possibility this was going to go out and I'd get emails from my friends being supportive and saying, oh, well, not to worry. And that, I worried that it would flop. I mean, it started to become clear that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
When the book went out, and when, you know, Radio 4 are going to make it Book of the Week and The Guardian want to serialise it.
It was very well received, yeah.
And you go, oh, okay, well, this is going to be all right then. So, I mean, that was, rather than sort of, you know, anything triumphant, you know, I greeted that with relief. I was just massively relieved that people were reading it and that people were enjoying it. And then I went through a very pleasant few months of every day I would hear from readers who said that it had helped them because it touches on grief and it touches on all kinds of sensitive areas, and people telling me that it had touched them. So I was really, I was pleased about that. But in terms of trepidation, in terms of how I'm seen, not really, because if people think that I'm Jez, that's fine. That just goes to show that I've played that character convincingly. From an artistic point of view, that's great. From a professional point of view, that's not great, because, you know, I've only ever played one character, as far as a lot of the audience is concerned, even though I've done loads of other stuff. But I'm known for Jez, and that's fine. So I wasn't worried that they think I'm Jez, because I know that I'm not, and I know that I'm that I'm a bit smarter and a better writer and a slightly more ambitious and, dare I say, successful individual than Jeremy Osborne. But I don't really have any control over how I'm perceived, so I don't worry about it.
No, but it sounds like a very satisfying experience. I mean, to get that wave of people who were moved by your memoir and by what you wrote about your mum and everything, that must have been quite a lovely year, was it?
Yeah, it was. It really was. And I'm always a bit shy of admitting that that writing the book had a cathartic effect, because it feels like that I wasn't paying sufficient attention to the reader. I mean, obviously it was written for other people. It's an outward looking and hopefully generous book, but there was a collateral benefit, which was that it did help me to frame those events in my own way. There's a satisfaction to be had there.
Yeah,
definitely.
And so the process of writing the novel then felt quite different, did it?
It did, yeah, because I didn't have this big head start. I had this half a page of A4, and it's a really good start to a story, but then I had to think of a satisfying, I hope not happy ending, in a kind of glib kind of, you know, somebody comes back to life happy ending, but it's a satisfying ending, and one that's sort of true to the story, and then I had to think of something interesting that happens in the middle and then join it all up.
Yeah.
that's my system, apparently.
Did you enjoy writing it?
No, not to start with. I enjoyed the bits. I enjoyed the beginning because I knew what I was doing. And then the more I did find that I was planning ahead, the happier I was. And the last third, in fact, it's divided into three parts. And that third part, I did plan. And so I wrote that very, very quickly. And I think it turns out, you know, the pantser versus the planner, I think I am a planner. Next time I'll plan more thoroughly. I don't think, if I'd planned Come Again, I don't think it would be a better book. I think I just would have had a less stressful time.
Yes.
Making it. So it was, that first draft was tough. And then after that, it got much, much better. And again, you know, to make that distinction between the coming up with the plot and the story and making all that work on its own terms versus the nitty gritty of getting down to the sentences. When I'm talking about style or jokes or effects that I want to achieve or little treats that I want to give to the reader and all of that stuff, that's absolutely joyful, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask sort of what you're striving for as a writer. It sounds like you're thinking a lot about that kind of reader experience is such an awful expression, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to be an entertainer.
Yeah.
Again, that's essentially how I see it, that these books are a new way for me to entertain people.
Yeah.
And so I want to make that as good as I possibly can, in the same way if I was wearing a leotard and a big curly wig and jumping up and down on live television, I'd want to make that as good as I possibly can as well. In fact, better than it needs to be would be my motto.
Yeah.
So that there's a great pleasure. The sort of performer in me, the showman, is alive and well in these pages, because I see those drafts as rehearsals, and Francis is sort of my director. I mean, less useless and ever present than a director, more removed and more effective. But that's where I rehearse, and then it's, you know, it's showtime, and I, you know, I see that final draft as a performance. And I, you know, I'm really out to, I want to, you know, make people go, wow, that's my, I think that's sort of the why I'm here.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the pleasure I get from it, is making it as good as I can.
What have been the most useful things that you've learned about writing? I mean, either through, you know, the sketch writing and so on, or through the last, you know, the books that you've been working on?
I think in terms of the books, I'm learning that when I get stuck, it's because I'm not enjoying myself anymore.
Mm.
And it's because I've taken a wrong turn. I'm going down a path where I think I ought to do this, or I ought to have this happen in the story, or the character ought to do this, instead of what I would like to see, instead of what I would enjoy reading. Essentially, I'm, you know, I've got quite a short attention span as a reader. I've become an idle and chaotic reader. And I think that is really useful for me as a writer, because I've got to keep my own attention. I can only write the book that I want to read. Come Again is absolutely the book I'd be reading now if I hadn't written it. I'm like Garth Marenghi. I have written more books than I have read. So that, you know, that's my approach. And so usually if I was stuck or blocked, I would, what were the last 600 words that I wrote? That's the problem. That's where I took a wrong turn. Get rid of it. And so it's just having the guts to, not guts for crying out loud, but it can be slightly painful to, because you will have, knowing me, I would have already noodled around with these sentences for numerous times. My first draft is really draft 20, because I've been pissing around with every sentence for so long. So I, you know, just get rid of those last 600 words and start from the place that you last were enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
That's, I think that's the new thing that I know now that I didn't know before.
Yeah. And what do you feel proudest of as a writer, looking back?
I'm quite pleased with this novel. I mean, for a first go, I think it's come out quite well. I mean, it's funny the way it's been reviewed, actually, in that I'm very grateful to have any reviews, but a couple of people in the sort of posher newspapers have sort of gone, this is an eccentric debut. Words like eccentric and lively. And because it does cross several genres, what have we got here? It's a grief-stricken, time-travelling, rom-com, adventure, action thriller. And so it's sort of, it's like this very, very badly behaved child that everyone finds endearing anyway. That's how it feels. I keep being reminded of Brett Anderson says something. I used to like Suede, and Brett Anderson says something in one of his books about those early singles, that they were so original because the band didn't quite know what they were doing. And I think there's a strong possibility I don't quite know what I'm doing. And that's why my first novel is absolutely all over the place. And if I've got it to cohere, it's through having a reasonably strong voice and a reasonably strong central character who sort of glues it all together and keeps it all, you know, as one book. But I think next time I'll have to show a bit more discipline. Or maybe I won't, I don't know.
That was Robert Webb, and if you'd like to buy his books, his novel is called Come Again, and his memoir is How Not to Be a Boy. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with somebody else who might enjoy it. I would love that. And as always, feel free to come and talk to me about it on Twitter or Instagram, where I'm very easily found by searching my name. See you next time.